You will face other challenges, other disruptions, and other crises. When you do, I hope and I speak for all of us in this family that you are able to draw strength from the experiences and resources you have developed this past year.
Brian Bauer, the leader of Granada Hills Charter High, speaking to the graduating class of 2021. It is the end of the school year and also the end of an era for the Los Angeles Unified School District. Austin Buettner steps down today after 3 years as the superintendent. In his farewell speech, he said LAUSD is well on the path to recovery.
The future of our community is in our public schools, and I'm pleased to say that the future looks bright.
We're going to look at Austin Buettner's legacy with two guests, beginning with LAUSD board member Jackie Goldberg. Hi, Jackie. Welcome back to Press Play.
Nice to be with you, Madeline.
Well, nice to have you. You were suspicious of Austin Buettner at first because he didn't come from education.
I was more than suspicious. I actually went to the board. I wasn't on the board yet. I went to the board and I testified when they were getting ready to vote that he was the wrong guy for the job because he hadn't had any classroom experience, hadn't been a principal, hadn't been anything.
So what changed your mind?
But I was wrong.
Oh, you were wrong. Okay, so how did your mind change? What happened?
Well, my mind changed because he's the right guy for the pandemic. I mean, he immediately saw beyond just our students, but to their families. He immediately saw that we needed to be feeding not just the students, but their families and other people who were hungry because of the pandemic and couldn't get work and couldn't get food. He immediately saw the need that we were to get new Chromebooks or ThinkPads or iPads or laptops. So he immediately ordered 500,000 of them. He put together a group with the county, and they began to talk about what testing we would need to do to keep our kids and our adults safe. Almost everything that LA Unified did to deal with the pandemic and our students and our faculty and our staff at schools was copied by other districts or used by other districts. So he really was magnificent. I mean, he was just magnificent. I can't praise him enough.
Wow. That's surprising coming from you, Jackie.
And I had to tell him to his face that I was really sorry that, but I don't know that I would have been wrong if he had been the superintendent in normal times, because I was looking for academic leadership. And he did get the academic leadership of the district that was already in place moving on all of those issues. So even there, I think he did well. But my objection was, I do believe superintendents should have some personal experience with what goes on in schools besides having attended them when you were a kid. But in a pandemic, he was the right man for the right job at the right time.
Right. But maybe that's not the case. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe with such an enormous district as LAUSD is, the second largest in the nation, that you do need someone with more of a management expertise than an educational background. Who knows? One of the things he really wanted to do was decentralize LAUSD. That failed.
No, I don't think so. No. We have community of schools, about 42 of them now, that are taking major responsibilities for helping schools and supporting schools. He did decentralize decision-making, not all of it, but that parts which are the most important to schools, which is parents can't get online. What do I do? Well, you don't have to call one IT number downtown for 42 different communities of schools. You call the community of school you're in, and their IT person, because they now have an IT person, takes care of the problem. So in terms of providing support and services to the schools, the decentralization is complete. What is not complete is that central, because board members still want them, we still make allocations of things. We decided that we were going to have a psychiatric social worker and a nurse added to every school during the pandemic, right? Okay, that's not something that those community of schools or local districts got to decide. So yes, there is still some central decision making. But more and more, it is being pushed outward because that is his notion, to get the support closer to the schools.
Well, let me ask you about the biggest criticism that he has received, and we're going to hear more about this in a moment when we hear from a parent, and that is that the Zoom education for the last, 15 months or so has been pretty underwhelming for most students, to put it mildly. A lot of students had a terrible experience. And then when it came to bringing the kids back to the classroom, the high school students had to do Zoom in a school. And of course, very few of them found that appealing. In fact, I think only about 7% went back.
We didn't want to do anything that CDC and the County of Los Angeles Health Department said we couldn't do. And they said we couldn't have any of our students at the time we reopened in more than one pod a day. Okay, so you got six classes. What do you do? Right? What do? You're going to get one pod.
But the CDC also said that you could reopen schools without teachers being vaccinated.
But we opened with everybody vaccinated. It wasn't the vaccination of the faculty that was holding things up. It was that the students are unvaccinated.
Right. But I'm just saying that is what the CDC said.
And without testing and without being able to say that we've got them in one pod all day, we would not be able to know if there was spread and how the spread was spreading. So we did what was safe. We've had no outbreaks in our schools. Was it awful for everybody? You bet it was. It was awful. But, you know, what was the better solution? We have done nothing except follow the medical advice of Johns Hopkins, UCLA, and Stanford, and the County Health Department.
All right. Jackie Goldberg, LAUSD board member, thanks for coming back on the show today.
Very nice to talk to you, Madeline. Stay well.
You too. All right, let's bring in Dana Rosenthal now from West LA. She's an LAUSD parent of two. One child attends an LAUSD school. The other child attends a special needs school funded by LAUSD. Welcome to the program, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. So what do you make of what Jackie Goldberg had to say there? I know you're very critical of keeping the schools basically Zoom only or open for very limited in-person instruction. She says the board and Austin Buettner avoided a major outbreak at any school. So what do you make of what she just said?
I mean, first of all, Jackie Goldberg is notorious for not listening to parents. She shuts down when parents actually criticize her. I've been on some LAUSD board meetings where she literally gets off the Zoom when parents try to say anything critical of LAUSD or UTLA. But I mean, honestly, I think they took the safety precautions to a whole different level where all other schools in the nation were open and didn't have outbreaks. LAUSD was the last major school district to reopen, and they took safety precautions to a level that were ridiculous, and our kids were suffering. Also, when the schools did reopen, they were forced to be 6 feet apart, and the CDC said 3 feet. So that meant that they were forced to be in these cohorts when they could have been full time in school. And like you said, the secondary schools were forced to be Zoom in a room. I can't even begin to tell you how my kids were mentally and academically challenged for the last year and a half among, all my peers and their kids. I mean, this was a disaster. And frankly, all of these people should be losing their jobs.
So the argument is that they prioritized health and safety over learning, and that they had to because this is a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, that normally they would not obviously do that because they're in the business of teaching kids. But in this circumstance, it was more important to save lives. That's the argument. And that, yes, the last year and a half was awful for most students, but that was necessary and preferable to death.
Well, I mean, the teachers were vaccinated and, they had all these examples from all these other school districts around the nation, including New York, which has the same demographics more or less as LAUSD and not the same weather as favorable as LA, where we could have been sitting outside. They could have pivoted. They could have thought of different ways to teach these kids in person. Instead, they couldn't think of other ways to get these kids back. And then again, they were handicapped And we're only going by what UTLA was saying. So they were negotiating and wasting precious time. They were, you know, they were negotiating all of this when the kids could have been back in school, when the elementary could have been back in school in February, in secondary, in March. They were negotiating all of this and wasting all this time. So academically, I don't know what they were doing, but I really don't understand what the outcome is, because a lot of these kids are never going to recover. My kids personally have regressed a full year. And think about all these lower income kids. They've literally, they'll never get back what they lost. I mean, it's really a criminal act what they've done. And they can say all they want that it was safety and health, but I don't buy it.
So do you place the blame with Austin Buettner then, as he is ending his tenure?
Absolutely, 100% I place it with him. I really think he, you know, he was not strong enough. I think that he really kowtowed to the union and he, you know, every demand. And listen, I mean, all us parents, we wrote and we called and he did not listen to us. This is a perfect example of why parents need a seat at the table. We cannot be sitting here looking inside from the outside. They need to listen to the parents. This is not like acceptable to be sitting here where, you know, the LAUSD school board and the teachers union are making these decisions and parents don't have a say. I mean, this is unacceptable. Parents have really woken up during the pandemic. And we know there's a lot at stake for kids' education and public education. This is not going away. There's a lot of work to do. And like you said, I also like what Jackie Goldberg said about, you know, these community of schools. That's also, I don't buy that. I mean, you know, we're still a big district, these community of schools. I mean, we're still like held all together by a centralized district. We're still, you know, East LA and West LA, we're all still tied together. We are all still centralized. So, I mean, I'm all for breaking up the district. It is too large. You know, we really should be operating, you know, in different districts. But I mean, you know, the low income kids, they are suffering. And, you know, Buettner turned a blind eye to the academics of the lower income kids. And has told teachers they're not allowed to fail them. So they're graduating at rates that are unacceptable and they are not going to be set up for success going forward. So I don't know what to say about that. But I mean, the next superintendent needs to be putting kids first. Kids first. It's kids first, parents first.
Dana Rosenthal, she has two kids in LAUSD schools. Dana, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, it's a big summer for travel. Does that mean the airline industry is okay now? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, chances are you are ready for a vacation, probably for the first time in more than a year. Vaccines are here. Masks are optional most of the time. Cities around the world are reopening. Well, your getaway plans are exactly what struggling airlines have been hoping for. According to the TSA, traveler numbers are almost back to pre-pandemic levels. Airlines like United are hoping this continues. Just this week, that company placed its largest order to date for new planes. With me to talk about whether or not airlines are poised to make a big recovery is Brian Summers, editor-at-large for the travel industry publication Skift. Hello.
Hello, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so that's good news, I guess, for United, that they seem to be pretty bullish on travel, that they're ordering all these planes.
United is bullish on travel, but I think that it's important to mention a lot of these airplanes are going to come in 2024 and later when we hope that COVID is in our rearview mirror. Things are still a little bit dicey for U.S. airlines now, not during the summer. Things are going gangbusters for July and August. There's a lot of pent up demand. People really want to travel. But later in 2021, when the kids go back to school, when we hit the winter doldrums. Nobody's quite sure how the short-term demand will look.
Right. So right now, as I said, it looks like it is at pre-pandemic levels, right? So where are people traveling? Are they traveling domestically, abroad, all over?
Close to pre-pandemic levels, certainly not pre-pandemic levels in terms of revenue. Almost everybody is traveling right now, either domestically or in North America. It's still really hard to leave the United States. Europe is opening a little bit. There's some places that are easier to go than others. But we're still seeing most people travel to, say, Hawaii. It's very hot right now. National parks within the western United States. And then just going home to see grandparents, brothers and sisters, all that travel that got put on hold for 15 months or so.
Okay. So not so much foreign travel at this point.
It's hard to do. One problem still, Madeline, and some people care, some people don't, is you are required to get a COVID test to re-enter the United States. And that can be a bit of a pain for people. If you're vaccinated, you're probably not going to get COVID, right? But what happens if you test positive for some reason, you're in Los Cabos in Mexico, and the U.S. government doesn't let you come home for a while? These are things that people have to wrestle with. Another thing is a lot of countries in Europe, places people want to go, are still requiring testing to get in. Again, if you're vaccinated, you're probably going to be okay, but it's a pain. So a lot of people are just deciding they didn't travel for 15 months or so, and they just want to stay closer to home.
Mm. Really? So you need to take a COVID test whether or not you've been vaccinated if you travel abroad from any country?
Madeline, my wife and I are scheduled to go abroad next month. It's something I really want to do because I love to travel. We're going to need to take three tests, one before we leave, one when we get to the destination at the airport for them to decide whether to let us in or not, and then a third to get back into the United States. So it's not normal times yet.
Oh, wow. Okay. So when you do get on an airplane, what is the experience like? Is it different than it was pre-pandemic?
Well, if you're flying domestically, you don't have to worry about any of that testing. It's roughly the same experience as before the pandemic, with one big caveat. You mentioned in your intro that we don't wear a lot of masks anymore, even in California. But federal guidelines require you to still wear a mask on an airplane. Those guidelines are in effect at least until the middle of September. So if you're flying cross country to New York, you might be wearing a mask for 5-6 hours or so, taking it off only to eat or drink. And anecdotally, that seems to be irritating a bunch of people. And we've seen these stories in the news about people getting into fights with flight attendants and things like that because they don't want to wear their masks.
Yeah, I've heard that too. So I guess the working conditions for the people, the flight attendants and the pilots, aren't as great. They're pretty stressful.
No, they're not. But I've been covering airlines for a long time. A lot of the people that work for airlines just love it. They've wanted to do this since they were kids. There's a romanticism about flying all over the country and all over the world. And a lot of people that work for airlines are just thrilled to be back.
So we talked about recreational travel. What about business travel? Because that's where airlines make a lot of their money.
Yeah, business travel is not back. Anecdotally speaking, some of the airlines have said about 70% of business travel has not returned. Airlines are hoping it does return. There's some optimism that maybe after Labor Day, the business travelers will come back. Nobody knows for sure. One thing that the industry is looking at is just how offices reopen. It's hard to think that business travel is going to come back in big terms unless you can go back to your office first. So that's one thing they're looking at. And then the second thing is budget constraints. Business travel is very expensive for big companies. You got to pay for expensive plane tickets and rental cars and hotels. A lot of companies have saved a ton of money over the past year not sending people on these trips. And it's possible that some large corporate industries are going to say, why are we sending you to New York for a 1-hour meeting? Isn't Zoom good enough?
What about you personally? I mean, the last time we spoke, you were very cautious about getting back on an airplane. How do you feel now?
I have not been back on an airplane yet, but like a lot of people, I have had enough. I am fully vaccinated, and boy, Madeline, do I have a lot of trips scheduled in July. So I can't wait to get back out there. I'm looking forward to traveling again.
Wow. Okay. Me too. Brian Summers, editor-at-large for the travel industry publication Skift. Brian, always great to talk with you, and happy flying.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the author of the popular LGBTQ advice column, Hola Papi.
And I'm always really anxious that I'm going to one day write this like really nuanced take on someone's relationship situation, and the whole internet is going to be like, are you serious? They need to break up like immediately.
John Paul Bremer, he's here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Hola, papi. That's the phrase that my next guest says white guys would send to him on the gay dating app Grindr. John Paul Bremer grew up in a Mexican-American family in rural Oklahoma, in a small town with very few people, let alone any kind of gay or Mexican-American community. And when he saw this fetishizing phrase, knowing it was just one of the many awkward, racialized moments that can come with online dating, for some reason, it stuck with him. Even as he came out of the closet, moved to New York, and became a writer. Years later, when he was offered a job to write an advice column, he chose to call it Hola Papi. Now the column has become a staple of the internet, widely read for its humorous yet compassionate advice on issues like being single during the pandemic, coming out of the closet, or what to do if you're jealous of your hot friend. That column is now a book called Hola Papi, How to Come Out in a Walmart Parking Lot and Other Life Lessons. And John Paul Bremer joins me now. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Well, your column began on Grindr, on the digital magazine called Into, which is part of Grindr. Mm-hmm. And you say you began it as a parody. And why did you want it to be a parody at first?
So I wanted it to be a kind of satire parody at the beginning because I thought the joke would be, what if Dear Abby was on Grindr? And what if the role was being filled by a gay Mexican instead of Abby? I thought that was so funny. And also because I thought I was way better at making jokes than I would be at giving any sort of legitimate advice, because giving advice seemed to me to be an actual responsibility. But making jokes and playing with the format of the advice column, that was more of a creative pursuit that I could get my brain around. So it started out that way, but then the letters started coming in and they were quite serious. And I realized I had to start taking the job with a little bit more responsibility.
Right. And so your advice isn't like Dear Abby, where she's kind of this on high voice of authority saying, well, this is what you need to do with your life. It is, wow, I've encountered this problem, too. And here's how I'm grappling with it, which I think is great because it really makes it relatable and human. So how do you feel about exposing your most intimate sides of yourself so publicly?
Yeah, you know, the brain that I work with when I'm writing is a very different one from the one that I have when I'm watching the reactions to my writing. So while I'm writing, I'm mostly just concerned with making sure it's written well. I'm putting things together. It's a very much composer mindset. And then once I'm done with it and put it out into the world, it's almost like I am then a different person who has to deal with the fact that I did that. So I'm sort of waiting now to get the feedback and the reactions to these very vulnerable parts of my life that I wrote about. But in the act of writing them, I really wasn't afraid or anything. I just thought this would make a really compelling story and I want to share it.
Well, let's talk about your middle school, because that's a really tough passage. And it's a really tough part of your life where you were bullied mercilessly in middle school. Can you talk about that a little bit? You were an outcast for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And then this guy comes to the school from out of town and he's instantly popular and you try to befriend him. Mm-hmm. And then he becomes part of a bullying clique.
Yeah, it was. I come from a very rural environment, a very small town. And one of the issues was I was perceived as gay. And I don't say that the issue was that I was gay, because I wasn't at the time out to anyone. I didn't understand what my identity was. It was more that people were policing any sort of behavior that seemed out of line for a boy to have, you know, the way I walk, the way I talk, my interests. Mm. And so when this new kind of weird person with a new style and a new way of talking moved in, I really thought, okay, well, maybe now is my chance to, you know, buddy up with the new outcast. But I came to find that he actually instead immediately became popular. And that was sort of where I learned what the power of humor and charisma can really do. It can make people accept things that they didn't accept before. He was wearing pink all the time and he had a weird way of talking, but because he made people laugh, everyone else was suddenly cool with it, even though they were so fine with attacking me for it.
Right. And just the lasting trauma that those few years mm-hmm. caused you. And I mean, I don't know how long ago that was, but are you still grappling with that?
Oh, yeah, I would definitely say so, because the thing about trauma is once it sort of nestles into your brain, it kind of immediately sets to work with shrinking your vocabulary for different experiences in your life. So, for example, later on when I would make friends and they would make a little playful joke about me, my brain would immediately say, they're about to turn on you. You need to fight or flight sort of thing. Like, you need to either hurt them back or you need to run away from this person. And so it wasn't until I started taking more therapy and years later that I looked back on some of the things that I chose to do in my life and realized, wait, that's all connected to when I was abused as a kid. And that's such a wild thing to realize later in life.
Yeah, I know. And I think when people are talking about abuse, childhood abuse, they often don't think about childhood abuse by peers.
Yeah.
You know, you automatically think childhood abuse by adults. But
yeah,
I mean, at that stage in your life, that was so powerful and so damaging.
Yeah, and you know, your brain is just a sponge when you're at that age. You're just soaking up everything right. And taking lessons away from every little thing that happens. And when bad stuff happens to you at that time, it can truly leave a crater. And you just sort of have to work around it as you grow up.
Yeah. Well, I guess one small victory is one of your tormentors, one of the middle school bullies you mm-hmm. later saw years later on Grindr.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, what a wild time. So it was Grindr's relative, Scruff. There's very little difference between the mix-up. Scruff is more geared toward like hairier, bigger guys, or at least it used to be. Nowadays, it's just sort of like, we're the chill Grindr, like that sort of situation. Uh-huh. But yeah, I was visiting home around Thanksgiving, and I get a message on Scruff from this faceless profile. And after chatting for a bit, I realized it was one of the people who tormented me in middle school. And I went on a whole mental trip when I read that message.
And did you talk about it with him? Did you confront him? Did he acknowledge what he did to you back then?
I said, you know, do you remember what happened? Do you remember what you did to me? And he was like, no, not really, but I was a real back then. Just like a very casual thing to say, because this is the person who, when I was in the lunchroom, he hit my face back and forth with a hot dog wiener and said, you know, I thought you're supposed to like this. Do you like this? Like that sort of thing. And I remember that so vividly. Mm. And the conclusion that I really reached was, you know, this is a person who was very afraid. This was a person who thought that if they targeted me as publicly and viciously as they could escape being in the position I was in. And I realized I was so desperate to escape that position myself that I might have done the same thing if I was given the opportunity. And it made it very hard for me to consider myself, you know, the perfect victim in that whole thing.
Oh my gosh, that's so compassionate of you to come to that conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, I still like was furious with him and I didn't forgive him, but I did sort of think like, this is how the world works. This is how pain travels. And I can say whatever I want to him in this moment and it will not actually make me feel any better.
Right, right. Well, the other thing about growing up in your small town is not only were there a few gay people around, but few Latinos, like your family, right? And your family was really bent on assimilating.
Yes.
And you write that you got this job at a place called Rosa's Tortilla Factory. Mm-hmm. And it caused a lot of tension with your with your grandma. Can you describe why?
Yes. My family comes from Chihuahua, Mexico, and the lives that my abuelos lived were kind of in keeping with a lot of the, I guess you would just call it, stereotypes people have for Mexicans. You know, my abuela dropped out of elementary school because she struggled with English and she turned to manual labor. My abuela was very poor. They were always poor my entire life. And yet, despite all that, despite very much sticking out in the America that I was raised in, they were some of the most fervent believers in America in a way that my mom and the way I am not. I have a lot of criticisms for this country that we're in, but despite being so badly treated and despite all the hardships they went through, not having money, my abuelo couldn't sit with his baseball teammates at the same restaurant when he was a kid. Still at the same time, they had this idea of America as this place that could provide, maybe not for them, but for their children and their children's children. And they held that belief so close to their chest, and it really saturated almost everything they did. So the idea of forgetting the language, the idea of moving away from a lot of the traditions. But then, of course, I grew up in a world where I feel like I'm pretty much assimilated. I feel like I'm pretty much everyone else. And then one little hiccup happens, and I think, wait, I'm not exactly like everyone else. What's going on here? And then I go on this whole identity crisis of trying to be a quote-unquote authentic Mexican, but I have nothing to point to in my life that would validate that except for my abuelos, who actually engineered the way that my life looked at that moment, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. But what you're saying is, it's funny, these two stories, they're so similar in a certain way, because they just seem to be shrouded in shame and fear on the part of your abuelas and on the part of this kid who bullied you, that this was a way for them to survive, to assimilate. But it was based in shame of who they authentically were.
There is very much an economy of assimilation, and it often comes at the expense of other people. So for every inch that you assimilate in, you know, America or mainstream culture or in a heterosexual world, in a cisgender world, for every inch you assimilate, there has to be someone else who gets pushed further away. You know, a lot of the times you're leaving people behind you, and that's not necessarily means that you're the villain or you're the bad person. It's just that it's a really difficult position that we put a lot of people in. And having been on both sides of that between, you know, being in the middle school and then in the tortilla factory, where I had all this privilege relative to my coworkers who I wrote about, people who were undocumented, who had to work several jobs at once, and I was sort of using it as this cultural exchange project. I kind of wanted to capture those two things, because most of us, I think, live on both sides of that equation. We have things where, you know, we get handed benefits, and we have moments where we're punished for things. And I think that's part of human life and nuance.
Last year, you got a letter that began, "I'm a cool young lesbian in one of the gayest cities in the U.S., and no one has ever been in love with me." And then she goes on to say she's doing everything right. She's going out. She's swiping right. She's still nothing. Mm-hmm. And she says, well, maybe I'll never find anyone. You know, I might go through life and I may never find anyone. And I love your response, because you're like, I'm not going to tell you that's not true, that there's someone for everyone, but that maybe that is true.
Yeah.
Which I was like, oh, wow. Continue reading. What do you mean? And then you wrote, well, same with me. And I was also surprised to see that you admitted you hadn't been in an official relationship since you had a girlfriend in high school.
Yeah.
Was that hard to admit in writing?
It is a little bit, just because, you know, loneliness is this really difficult thing to describe, because it comes with so much shame. There's this idea that, well, if I'm lonely, it means that I'm doing something wrong. But I think that when we admit that we're lonely, we actually kind of are able to connect with a whole lot of other people who are also lonely. Because the reality is, it's not just romantic situations where people experience loneliness or unwantedness. It's sort of all over the place, be it at our jobs, with our friends. So I just wanted to, in that column, kind of be like, listen, I know where you're coming from, because I'm not, just because I'm the advice columnist doesn't mean I'm living this perfect life and I know exactly what you need to do. But I did enjoy just being able to validate someone in that way, because as a person who's also chronically single, I sometimes get tired of all the weird little tricks that people, like they say to me, like, yeah, of course there's nothing wrong with you. You're out of your mind. Like, no, you're being silly. And sometimes I don't want to feel like I'm being silly. And sometimes I don't want to just pretend that I'm not thinking about it. Sometimes I just want to sit in my desires and think, wow, I wish I had this thing that I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
That's also comforting mm-hmm. in a way.
Have you ever given a piece of really bad advice that you wish you could take back?
You know, nothing really comes to mind, only because usually when I give advice in Olapapi, it's because I'm extremely confident in it. I've had some that I've started and then thought, what are you doing here? And I'm always mm-hmm. really anxious that I'm going to one day write this like really nuanced take on someone's relationship situation. And the whole internet is going to be like, are you serious? They need to break up like immediately. I'm very afraid of that. So I avoid it like the plague. Anytime something reeks of like, this is complicated or too complicated, I'm like, you know, maybe I'll just read another letter.
Well, it has been a pleasure speaking with you today. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been amazing speaking to you.
Oh, my pleasure. That's Jean-Paul Braemer. His new book is called Hola Papi, How to Come Out in a Walmart Parking Lot and Other Life Lessons. We'll tell you about a cult foreign film that was, for decades, the most popular film in the Netherlands. Its director, Paul Verhoeven, went on to make big-budget American films. We'll talk about the one that wasn't a big-budget American film next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, America hasn't always loved foreign films. Far from it. We are beginning to wake up, though. Films like Parasite and Another Round won big here in the United States. And our good friend and culture enthusiast Rico Galliano is trying to fan those embers with his new podcast. It's called Mubi Podcast, M-U-B-I, after the new global cinema streaming service. And its debut episode, which came out earlier this month, looks at a little-known gem from the Netherlands from the 70s called Turkish Delight. Little-known here in the States, but the film was a blockbuster over there. It held the record for most movie tickets sold for more than 20 years in the Netherlands. Here to talk about this film and his new podcast is Rico Galliano. Hello, 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 my friend.
Hello. So lovely to be talking to you, and thanks for having me on.
And we're talking about Turkish Delight, which I confess I'd never heard of.
Yeah, so, really? I know that you were kind of a punk really? Back in the day, and this is kind of a punky movie. It surprises me that you didn't get a chance.
Well, I can't see them all. But anyway, so catch us up as to what this film is all about. It's directed by Paul Verhoeven, whom I do know, you know, because he did RoboCop and Total Recall and Basic Instinct. But
and Starship Troopers.
Anyway, what is this movie about?
It is a not at all like any of those blockbusters you just mentioned. This was his sophomore movie, his second movie, and it is based on what was a blockbusting book, still is a very big best-selling book in the Netherlands called Turkish Delight, Turk's Fruit in Dutch. And it is about a guy named Eric, who is a sculptor, and it's about his relationship with this woman that he meets while hitchhiking in the Netherlands. They fall in love almost immediately and have this insanely erotic relationship that is attempted to be broken up by her mother, who disdains the fact that her daughter is going out with this kind of wild artist type. And they end up breaking up in a very terrible way. He pines for her. And so doing, he kind of ends up on this series of erotic escapades that just leave him sadder and sadder and more depressed. He just kind of leaps from one erotic adventure to another, not gaining any satisfaction. And I won't tell you the ending, but let's just say that it is it's a hell of a tearjerker. But along the way, it's also super sexy and super full of rage and farcical, and there's lots of death. And I describe it in the podcast as like this whiplash of melodrama and sex and comedy and social satire. And it when I first saw it, it blew my mind.
Wow. It sounds like it's a mind blower. And when did you first see it?
I saw it. It was actually just a few years ago. And if you know me, you know that I am a very big fan of the Netherlands. I went there every year for many years. And I thought that I had a grasp of the Dutch culture. And that's one of the things that sort of made me want to make this podcast, is that I had this idea of the Netherlands as, although it has this reputation for craziness with the red light district and everything, my feeling was that that was a place that they had created where, yes, you could go and freak out, mostly tourists could go and freak out, while they kind of just glided by living these very modest, kind of low-key lives. And then you see this film, and it's like, how did those people not only make this movie, but then go and see it en masse? This movie, a quarter of the population turned out to see it in 1973 when it came out. And I just wanted to see if I could figure out something about this country and these people that I loved by kind of exploring more what was going on with the film.
Well, you talked to the director, Paul Verhoeven, and I just want to play a clip of him talking about why he loves this story so much.
Because it's interesting. It's true. Because there's truth there. It's not basic things that were invented. The sexuality that he describes is not something that's a fantasy. It's all based on reality. It's very, very autobiographical. And so these things happened that way. And basically, what's more beautiful than getting an honest tale?
An honest tale. But honest for him, because you just said that this is a wild ride, super sexually explicit and violent. And I mean, it sounds like Easy Rider on steroids.
I guess that's a descriptor that you could use. I mean, the thing to me that's interesting about that particular clip is that right afterwards in the podcast, you hear Jan de Bont, Paul Verhoeven's cinematographer, kind of contradicting him a little bit. Paul says that he's fascinated by the fact that the book that this story is based on is semi-autobiographical. Jan Volkers, the author, based it loosely on his life and his relationships. But Jan de Bont will tell you that Paul Verhoeven actually grew up in this kind of era of the Netherlands and an area of the Netherlands that was actually very restrained and very religiously kind of tight and conservative. And that this movie and a lot of his movies are kind of a reaction against that, to this kind of reform, Calvinist, very conservative world that he grew up in. And I mean, you can definitely feel almost everybody involved with this film kind of kicking against the restraints of the old Holland. This comes out in 1973 at a time when Holland is really almost literally the center of the counterculture universe. Like, people from all over the world were going to Amsterdam at that time. In some cases, literally sleeping in their answer to Central Park, the Vondelpark, in tents and just kind of smoking weed and hanging out. And it was just like this moment where I feel like a lot of that kind of kicking against the old ways was happening. And this movie was a reflection of it.
And you also interview one of the stars, Monique van de Ven, and she talks about how even on the set, there was this sexual freedom.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah, people actually walked around naked on the set. Here's a clip.
But nobody looked at it or nobody thought it was weird. You know, it was very uninhibited. You know, all of Amsterdam was very free and open, and there were, you know, hardly any taboos. I mean, coming out of this bourgeois morale, we didn't want that anymore. And we just wanted to be free. And it was exactly the right timing. You know, it has a lot to do with the timing.
Right. So as you say, Holland was just caught up in this burst of sexual expression and counterculture fervor.
Sure. I would say a burst of almost everything. I think everything was going on back then. There was just an incredible explosion of art. And the thing, by the way, the thing that I really love about kind of delving into this movie is learning about that moment in history in the Netherlands. I mean, it's hard really for us to fathom how kind of different it was. There was, not only was it a place where a lot of countercultural people were going, but people were capitalizing on this and allowing it in a way that I just can't even imagine today. Not only were things happening like, you know, can you imagine a movie set, first of all, where today, where you would just cavalierly be walking around nude on the set? I mean, there are people that you hire specifically to make sure that doesn't happen. But also,
exactly.
But also that there were, like, for instance, their KLM, the Dutch airline, and also I believe Delta Airlines were marketing flights to international hippies to go to the Netherlands and experience the scene, to the extent that KLM, remember, this is the Dutch airline, so the country's own airline, is advertising with ads that say, fly KLM, sleep in the Vondelpark. Like, imagine if Delta is saying, come to New York and sleep in Central Park. Like, that's what's happening right now when, at that moment in 1973.
Wow. So this film and the culture around it were quite the phenomenon. I'm just wondering, though, just from a purely cinematic experience, from just watching it, is it a good movie?
I mean, it is. I'll put it this way: you cannot take, like a lot of Verhoeven's movies, you cannot take your eyes off it. The way that I like to describe his movies, any good movie really works like this, but his movies especially, I like to think of it as something that I heard about both gambling and video games, which is the reason why those two things are so addictive is that there are very high highs and very low lows, and you never know when either of those are coming. That's very addictive to the human brain. And I feel like that's very true, especially of Verhoeven's early films. It's like you watch these things and you're like, I can't believe that that just happened, or I can't believe that that character just did that. Or consequently, when it can switch gears from this movie that is kind of hitting you full in the face with all of these very visceral things and suddenly switch to this very tender, extremely, you know, touching stuff. I mean, there are stories of people weeping in the theaters when this movie came out.
Well, speaking of, let's hear a clip from your podcast about the premiere.
The whole audience was holding their breath. You know, it was like they couldn't believe it.
The audience was enjoying every damn moment of the movie, everything. Damn it! And they were laughing to each other, looking at each other, isn't this great? It was probably one of the best experiences I ever had in my life.
And then at the end of the film, you hear sobbing and people are saying, no, no, oh my God, oh, this is terrible.
There you go.
Wow. So this thing became a phenomenon for years, right? It held a record for ticket sales for more than two decades, this movie,
yeah.
Turkish Delight.
Yeah, until Titanic came along and finally knocked it off its pedestal by not actually that many more admissions. It's kind of, and when you think about that, this movie comes out in 1973. That means no movie between 73 and 97 when Titanic comes out, it sells more tickets than Turkish Delight in the Netherlands.
And does that include Star Wars?
Yeah, that would mean Star Wars. That would mean, you know, Jaws. That would mean Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T. I mean, it's crazy. People really fell in love with it. One of my favorite parts of any episode in this podcast, actually, is the part where I kind of get into the impact that the movie has on the popular culture of the country in question. And in this case, it's things like the soundtrack became a huge hit. It was like a top 10 hit just below Dark Side of the Moon, which came out that same year. Monique van de Ven talks about walking around Amsterdam and there are like salons advertising for people to get her haircut from the film. It's kind of cool to kind of realize that there is a popular culture in another country that you just like have no, you cannot fathom. And hearing about just the delight that people had over some of these things. There are scenes from this movie still. I talked to somebody, a friend of mine in the Netherlands the other day who just listened to the podcast. And I mentioned this one famous scene that's a bike riding scene through Amsterdam. And she says that she literally whistles the soundtrack from this movie every time she's on somebody's bike in Amsterdam. This is a movie that's, you know, over 40 years old.
Hmm. Oh, wow. Well, Rico, you have definitely piqued my curiosity and I'm going to have to go see it. So good job.
One warning, not a date movie. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Noted. That's Rico Galliano. He's host of the new Mubi podcast. New episodes come out each Thursday. You can listen to them wherever you get your podcasts. It's a free download. Rico, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, it's already shaping up to be a great summer here at KCRW. We have lots of events, free concerts, all for you, and we need your help now. We're in a very brief summer challenge grant situation, so donate now, and your gift can be matched up to $10,000 thanks to an entertainment law firm called McEwen, Frankel, and Whitehead. So if you missed us last summer, now is the time to give at kcrw.com/give. Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow.